Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Every time I talk to you, I just can't wait to have sex after.
Not that that sounds strange.
Yeah.
We are not told stories of a woman's strength aside from her silence and her sacrifice. I don't want to be the silent, sacrificing person. Most people don't really understand what Tantra is. Tantra is literally a philosophy. And it says that the eventual aim is to get to higher consciousness. They will only teach you up to a certain point. If you are not prepared to practice it, there are certain things that they will not allow you to learn. I can actually, walking on the road, stimulate myself through the mind, straight down over there, and actually bring myself to orgasm. I can get fully wet.
By just thinking or by
just thinking.
Pelvic floor?
No, by just thinking. You know, my waist curves in like this and my hips curve outwards. And I look at that and then I do this with my arms and I get really excited. I love me. Sorry, it's just weird. It's just, I love me. I love me. Oh my God, I'm sorry for loving myself.
Hello, friends. What's up, lovers? Oh, look at this camera. It's way up in the sky.
Hey.
Hello. It took me so long, guys, to put on my comma, to put on like the anklet, and then I had to put on the bells for the anklet, then I had to put on my spine chain. Like every attachment was just done with such care. So we put it together. So we got her. Boom. Boom. And we're ready to rock and last name rule. Thank you guys for being here. I'm really excited about this class, and I'm really excited that there are so many new faces that are coming to join us because, you know, shame is a universal experience that we never get an opportunity to connect on because we live with it inside of ourselves. So I'm so grateful, not just to Seema, but to all of you for taking part today. So in this very special London-based episode of Lovers, I got to sit down with the patron saint of pleasure, the living sex ed icon, a friend to all of us here, Seema Anand. Seema has a new book coming out called Speakeasy, and it's now available for pre-order, so let's make sure we support that. Plus, our collaboration jewelry line, Kama, is finally back in stock.
You believe it's magic.
Thank you all for selling it out 2 times. So, we talk about that, plus Seema's life, from a sheltered upbringing to learning the secrets of Tantra, to being shamed for her interest in the Kama Sutra, to now being the most famous interpreter of it. Seema's story weaves from shame to pleasure, then ridicule to renaissance. Now in her 60s, she's ready to bear it all and teach us how to stand proud in our own nakedness. We'll get into this interview, but before we do, warning, this video contains women proudly talking about something they created, and that creation has to do with sex. This episode was made possible because we had to get together to tell you that our jewelry line, Kama, is back in stock just in time for the holidays. Each item is designed to teach women how to prioritize their pleasure in different sexual positions, and it looks pretty amazing with clothes on too. So learn more and get yours before it's gone at surmai.com/Kama.
Unlike in the West, where they believe that when there is a natural calamity like famine or flood or earthquakes, that it is the wrath of the gods.
Empowerment, it's interesting. I think women are always chasing something.
In ancient India, they believed that it's because the earth had forgotten her pleasure. And she has to be reminded what it feels like to have the sap run through her veins, to have the flowers blossom on her branches.
You're chasing fitness, you're chasing fertility, you're chasing adoration, you're chasing respect. The modern woman is still chasing empowerment.
Because once her pleasure is in place, once she can feel her pleasure, all is right with the world.
And I feel like she doesn't have to run unless she likes it. But I feel like you can stay still and be empowered and be sensual.
The pleasure of the woman is what creates the balance of the universe. I feel irritable about certain things, and then it's like, So yeah, I need to fix that for myself.
Hi. Oh my gosh, what a journey. What a journey.
Everything is, right? And sometimes it's about your, it's about perspective. Because when I was 30, that journey was up to whatever I'd gone through at that point, which was a lot, but obviously at this stage, at 63, that journey is a lot longer. You've been through so much more that you've seen and done and experienced and felt and actually understood what you felt. So, you know, in Tantra, we have this thing, like when I went to study Tantra. For Tantra, most people don't really understand what Tantra is. Tantra is literally a philosophy. And it says that the eventual aim is to get to higher consciousness. It's to achieve God, if that's your vocabulary. It's to achieve moksha, nirvana, if that's your vocabulary. And I was told that with Tantra, they will only teach you up to a certain point. If you are not prepared to practice it, there are certain things that they will not allow you to learn. And I kind of came back from it. I was like, no, then I don't want to do this. Because a lot of the experiences or a lot of the things that they talk about in Tantra, the rituals, the traditions, they're a little off the charts. And they say that there is no such thing as good knowledge and bad knowledge. So if you're saying, oh, no, sex is bad. No, 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 that's bad stuff. Learn all the good stuff. Learn the scriptures. That's the good knowledge. There's no such thing as good knowledge and bad knowledge. Everything in this world has been created by some divine engineering. You need to understand everything to get to the next point.
Well, let's go from the very beginning. We have our little cup. I'll say we're having chai. That's a lie, though. I could even say we're having a proper cup of British tea. That's a lie, too. You're having Coke Zero. We're going to be honest, okay?
Well, we're doing this for the aesthetics.
It's right? The aesthetics, and it looks gorgeous. And of course, we're joined by our beautiful aesthetics, the Kama Jewelry, which to me, thank you.
No, thank you.
No,
you
thank
actually
you.
Made it come alive. You know, okay, so this is what it's about, right? You have the idea, the concept, and then some way of making it real. Before we met, I had talked about this jewelry for a good long time because it fascinates me, the idea, the concept of a time when pleasure and intimacy and sex, forget intimacy and beautiful words like that, just the fact that sex, pleasurable sex, was so important and so beautiful that you would actually teach women how to get to that point of pleasurable sex by how you ornamented yourself and how that ornamentation moved on your body. Because it's like, what do they call it now? Biofeedback? You know, you have these machines that people use now, which are like biofeedback. So when you're doing, for instance, your pelvic floor strengthening exercises, you have a little thing that you can wear inside your panties. And it tells you, it gives you a little buzz when it tells you when you're doing it right and when you're doing it wrong. So you actually know what you're doing. This was biofeedback from 2,000 years ago.
Wow.
And it just, you know, every word that I have ever grown up hearing has been so filthy around sex and around your body, around the female body, around female pleasure. I finally come to a point where you realize, no, it wasn't always like that. There was a real beauty around it. Because I don't know about you, but when I first started to speak up against the taboos and the stigma and this whole idea of women's pleasure not being a thing, it was very much from an activist's point of view.
Yes.
Yeah? So it was me saying, how dare you say this? No, it's fine. But you still carried all of that, all of the taboo with you. You carried that stigma with you because it was seen as a dirty thing. You were brought up believing it was a dirty thing. So you carried that stigma with you, and your vocabulary kind of worked around that. And it was only gradually that I learned about this. And then I know how my way of talking about it has changed. Because now when I talk about it, I actually visualize it. It's in my head. It's just this gorgeous thing, and I can feel my body reacting to the beauty of that. And yeah, so I talked about it, thought about it for a long time. It hadn't gone anywhere. And then you came along and you made it possible.
You know, what's so interesting about that is because I think when we very first talked for the first time, our complementary nature was you have a PhD in narrative studies and I'm a certified sexologist. So I'm very like science and practical. And so I remember when you told me about the jingling girdle and in essence, it teaching women that the way to orgasm while you're on top isn't to bounce, but to go back and forth. And this is something that many women stumble upon, but then they watch porn and think, am I doing it wrong? Mm-hmm. They wonder if, oh, am I boring my partner? So they stop actually prioritizing their pleasure. So to know that this text that's thousands of years old was giving them the permission to prioritize themselves and already knew kind of secrets that people are discovering almost by accident, I was blown away by that. But I love the story behind it. I love that we're wearing it right now and you don't even know what this jewelry went through last night.
Yeah.
You know, like yeah. You don't have to know the story of that. And it's the narrative component of it. And even actually, as you were just talking about how in many ways our work is activism based, right? Which activism, I'm not a very big fan of like masculine and feminine and those ideals, but activism at its nature kind of has a very masculine essence to it, right? Mm-hmm. It's very assertive. It's against the grain. It's a sense of leadership. It has to be even a little aggressive, right? Mm-hmm. But this is like very feminine activism. This is what this feels like to me. Like as a sex educator, it allows something else to do the heavy lift. Even our connection, I think, perfectly represents what Kama brought to life.
Absolutely. So, like I said, you know, you just said that you're very science-based, you're very fact-based. What I absolutely love is that whenever I have talked about anything, you've actually been able to understand what I'm saying and put it into modern-day vocabulary. Like, you've actually understood it each time. You know, I had done a video about one of our pieces where we talk the jingling anklets. You know, this whole idea that if you were underneath, so if you were in a sort of missionary position, how you change that missionary position just a little bit, where you would have your ankles over here on your partner's shoulders, and then the idea that you would bring, with each thrust, one
leg
down.
You know, I never understood this one.
Okay. So I'm going to tell you that.
We're together now. This is the one, I actually use the anklets for splitting bamboo, so one leg up.
Yeah.
And one leg down. Or I might do both legs up. But I never did this.
Okay.
And then it's supposed to be like a bicycle?
Sort of. So yeah, you would. But you know, you could actually also just do it as splitting bamboo.
Yeah.
The idea is that this gives you little micro movements, just a little bit, so that you keep adjusting your back, because your back is not supposed to be that still for your pleasure. You're not supposed to be just sort of, you know, lying there and not being able to move.
Yeah.
When pleasure runs through your body, you do need to, we do automatically need to move it a little bit.
I'm moving.
So, you know, it stops your back from freezing off. But also, this kind of rocks you a little bit, so it brings the connection to your clitoris a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Now, traditionally, the split would have been that the woman would have had one foot against the man's forehead mm-hmm. and the other one across his shoulder like this.
Now we're talking.
Okay. So like this and out like that, right?
Yeah.
And that's good enough too, because when you have it like that, again, there's a little bit more friction against the clitoris.
Mm-hmm. I love that concept. I love the idea of my foot on someone's forehead too. That turns me on.
Yeah. And I mean, traditionally, of course, the women would wear, they'd have red paste under their foot. And that's where that whole metaphor comes from, where if you then did that, it would leave a little bit of a red mark on his forehead. And Alta, which is what that paste is called traditionally, was really difficult to take off. Like, it doesn't come off very easily. So you could be scrubbing and it wouldn't come off. So when you saw a man with a little bit of red over there, you knew exactly what he'd been up to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so from this comes the idea of taking the woman's foot to your head means that you're lovers.
I think of sex as the place that you go where all of you gets to belong. It's the only place that you go where every sound that your body can make, every smell that can possibly come out of it, every liquid, every out of place hair, like everything can get brought to the table and maybe for the first time completely accepted and embraced by somebody else. Mm-hmm. Also, in a really safe space, it's a place where all of this gets to come.
Yeah.
You know, all of your various identities, your fears, your feelings, your insecurities, your joys.
Yeah.
What I love about this, too, is that it sets the tone for how that play is going to happen. So, as I was saying, choking is kind of a thing that people were doing. And I remember I was wearing the choker and my husband put his hand to my neck during lovemaking. But instead of grabbing it, he was just tracing.
Oh,
you know what I mean? He was tracing it, but kind of like this, right? So still a little bit of oxygen deprivation, but more of a massage than putting his hands along the charms. And so that just felt like, oh, like this is a way to invite a different type of touch and of connection.
It is very much about the touch, right? Because the moment there is a piece of jewelry, there's something more tactile. You do change how you touch. Anybody else going, let's say you're in the middle of making love.
Even seeing you do that was so sensual. Just one, because the fact that you picked one strand.
Well,
right?
It kind of is where my hand would go. I mean, I would literally feel that one way. I was just thinking, when you're in the middle of lovemaking and somebody's hand goes towards your chest, it's very automatically your boobs, right? It's a grab of the boob. It's an automatic kind of, because that's all the visuals that we've ever seen. How often do you actually see, like you said, the money shot, which has somebody just tracing your nipple or teaching you how to just trace the breast in a certain way? It's not really what you're shown. And you're shown that this is a point of urgency. This is excitement. This is passion rising. You know, the arousal is there. And so there's grabbing and there's squeezing, which is very pleasurable in its own time. But it's the only thing. So if you're adding another narrative to it, the moment you put something over here, suddenly you're not grabbing just the boob. You're now tracing bits of jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's helping you to get more creative.
This can also, we're going to stop doing the QVC in a second, guys, okay? Because last video we did, people complained. They were like, is this a podcast or QVC? We made this jewelry. We are excited about it. So we want to talk about it, okay? And I use it in my everyday life. And it is something, prior to this, I often use a vibrator necklace that I wear all the time. And that was a staple for years for me. Not necessarily because of the vibrator, which is a good vibrator, but just because of the empowerment it gave me. Mm-hmm. It was, for so long in my life, it's a dirty, shameful, secretive part of my life. And then I get this piece of jewelry that says, it's actually a very sensual, very chic, very complimentary piece of your life mm-hmm. that you get to wear wherever you go. And it's, if you know, you know. Right? I'm not walking around with a massive dildo with veins bulging, right? So I'm not drawing attention where I don't want it. Mm-hmm. It's a secret between myself and my body that I get to decide. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Because even with that vibrator necklace, I loved wearing it out. People would be like, oh, what is that? Like, you know, is that like a railroad spike? Is that a vial? Is there ashes inside? And I would say none of the above. That's it. And if I wanted you to know, I'd say, okay, touch it. See that button in the side? Now press it. And then it would turn on. Now you know. And I feel like this jewelry gets you the same opportunity, the same thing. You know, I get these compliments on it, especially the choker. Always. The choker is a showstopper. And then if somebody is someone I want to talk to further, I tell them about space and fire and passion and the parrot and lovemaking and love. I take the time with them. So I love that this jewelry gives you that opportunity to take it where you want to go. On that note, I wanted to say is that the 5-string necklace, although we also have the waist chain, mm-hmm. but sometimes I wear it around the waist.
Yeah.
And even again, as we go back to that you were doing, right? And we talked about this before too. Remember with the beads?
Yeah.
Yes, right? But imagine wearing that on your hip. How sensitive that area is and how often doesn't really get that attention. Every time I talk to you, I just can't wait to have sex after.
Not that sounds strange.
Yeah. You're like, that's my job. Okay. I want to go back and learn about you.
Okay.
You are so fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you know this. You have literally millions of followers and so many people around the world who are obsessed with you. And I don't even know if I personally know your story and how you came to be this patron of pleasure?
Where should we start? I was born in India. I am born into a family where women have an identity. Working mother, working grandmother, working great-grandmother, educated, not a problem. Then you go out into the real world and you get pushed down. But when it comes to, when it came to the idea of pleasure or intimacy, the stories were always the same. It was always how it's bad. You know, you grew up believing it was a bad thing. It was a sinful thing. You grew up without any education. I didn't have enough education to even know that there is, when you have sex, that there is a period during the month when you can get pregnant and not at other times. I just believed that if you had sex, I would get pregnant. Mm-hmm. I had no idea of anything else. This was told to me so much later, you would not believe. It was on the night before my marriage, that somebody said to me, a friend who's a doctor said, oh, by the way, it's going to be a little bit painful. And I was like, why? What? Who? What?
So you had never had a sexual debut. Your husband?
I was very young. I'd been told that, like I said, I hadn't been educated. I was 22, you know, when I got married. And I was like, I really thought that I was just going to have, if I had sex, I would get pregnant. Nobody had taught me how to use condoms. Nobody had told me about lube. Nobody. It was my husband who told me about lube. I mean, this is how bad it was. And I have always worked with stories. So I'd always worked with how the stories that we tell actually define our identity. You know, you tell stories of the good woman who keeps quiet. She's the good woman because she doesn't make a fuss. She doesn't dishonor her husband. She doesn't blab about things outside. When I got married, I still remember my aunt giving me this one piece of advice. If you get into a fight with your husband, she said, keep it to between you. Don't go and tell anybody outside. And I know it was good advice in its own way from her, but nobody said, look, if you have a problem, come talk to someone that you trust. That's what the advice should have been. We came from a very different time.
Well, tell me about you at 22. That's young to get married. Was it arranged? Was it a love marriage?
It was an arranged marriage. So my mother had always said that she did not want me to have an arranged marriage. She doesn't believe in them. And my mother's very cool. My grandmother was very cool. There were these very happening women. And I was in a rebellious phase. And I was just like, how do you rebel against very cool parents? You rebel by going onto the straight and narrow. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, then
you're not the first person to say this to me on this podcast.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I had this like weird curiosity about things that my mom were like, these things are dumb, just like any kid. That's the thing. And so because my mom was almost working in the opposite direction sometimes, even if it was well-intentioned, I was like, what's over there though? You know, mm. I was like, this is what you should be doing. This is the better. This is the light. This is the feminism. And I was like, but what's that? You know,
so think like, what's repression?
Right. I'm like, that sounds interesting. I want to be a trad wife. And I'm playing.
You know, when they talk about rebel without a cause, that was me.
Mm.
That was me.
But you were like goody two shoes without a cause.
Well, yeah. And there was also this inherent idea of going into marriage, a virgin. I still remember saying to Raul when we got married, I was like, I'm a virgin. And he was like, yeah, and? It was just like, don't be so silly. That's not even important. What on earth do you think makes you special if you're a virgin? So, like I said, I'm glad that I also married somebody who had enough understanding to sort of not double down on all those weird stereotypes and myths. And, you know, so part of the journey of sort of releasing yourself from that has definitely come from him too. But it was a lot of learning suddenly from not knowing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And from very typically, like most young women, at least in India, I don't know if it's all around the world, but at least in India, most of us masturbate by squeezing our thighs together.
Mm. Centrifugation.
Mm. Because it doesn't need privacy. You don't need equipment. It can be really as quick as you want. Easy way to do it.
I don't think it works for me.
Really?
No. Well, it's a form of orgasm that's referred to as hunching, but it's really just like when you can rub on a bed or you can rub up against something, and you could be on a bus even sometimes, right? Just even the up and down motion. The closest I ever got to like orgasm that wasn't direct clitoral stimulation with a finger or with a tongue or with a vibrator was on a horse. But even then, I couldn't get all the way to the top, and I was like, this is one hell of a ride. But I don't know if I get enough of what I require through centribation. But I think that's a really beautiful gift to have. Is it a superpower to do that?
I think it's a wonderful power. I'm not sure if it's a superpower. I'll tell you what my superpower for orgasms is, though. And that's a superpower. So I think that, yeah, squeezing your thighs together is fantastic if you can do it. I think a lot of women develop how to do it out of necessity. The downside on that is that you then find very difficult to come with your legs open because you get used to doing that. And it took me years because, again, I didn't know what all I could do to help myself get past that. If I'd had the education, I would have helped myself to get past that earlier. But I'll tell you what I can do. I can actually, walking on the road, stimulate myself through the mind, straight down over there, and actually bring myself to orgasm. I can get fully wet. I can actually just do that.
By just thinking or by
just thinking.
Pelvic floor?
No, by just thinking. I can actually feel the sensations in my vagina by focusing on them in my head. I can be in the middle of Oxford Street with traffic around me, can be having my little... And it's like, you know, when you use a vibrator and you place some... It's not immediate orgasm. It's that whole pleasure journey. It's that whole build-up. That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, my gosh. That actually is so... you.
This episode is sponsored by Aria, a service that I'm a subscriber of and chief intimacy officer of. Aria helps couples make breaking the routine the new routine by giving them a new experience to try in the bedroom and beyond each month. Then you get access to a text-based concierge that will answer all of the questions that you cannot ask anywhere else, plus an app that teaches you about your scene, best tips, erotic inspiration, playlists, and so much more. And finally, you'll get a discreet box mailed to you with all the items you'll need to really make the experience come to life. This holiday season, we're giving you the chance to gift your partner an Aria membership, plus anyone who purchases a 3, 6, or 12-month membership will receive our intimacy card deck for free, sent separately as a small, tangible gift you can slip into a stocking or briefcase. Head to aria.fyi/shan to get started by taking a free erotic persona quiz. Personally, I'm a director in the bedroom. How about you?
Yeah, well, as the patron saint of pleasure, you have to learn how to do these things, right?
It's so you, and it's also very inspiring to me because I orgasm very frequently in my sleep.
Okay.
So that tells me I can. I just don't know how to do that in my conscious hours.
You can. You just have to focus a little bit more on it.
Mm.
I think it's the tantric breathing exercises. It's that whole awareness, body awareness thing. You know, you can learn to move your energy from one point to the other, just with your breath. And for everybody listening out there, it's not that complicated. You know, when we talk about moving your energy from one place to the other, all you do is you breathe, you focus on the breath that you're taking in and out. And then you consciously travel from one point of your body to the other. You consciously go into that part of the body. So it's just about moving your breath.
When you said that, for some reason, I thought of a mosquito bite. Because you know when you have a mosquito bite and it's itching and all of your energy, all of your thought process, like,
is on that
singular point.
I mean, probably the best way to destroy any ideas that I was having about, you know, the pleasure that I was feeling down there. But yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
mosquito bite.
Well, you know when you said, like, it's not that complicated because, yes, sometimes we can think of Tantra as being very complicated, having multiple steps, needing to go through different levels of enlightenment to even get to that place where it's possible.
But then when you put it into those words, like, yeah, we've all had a time when a singular part on our body took over every thought, every preoccupation. And it's just because you placed all your energy there. So
yeah, it's like if a stray hair lands on your arm. Mm. It's your skin is so sensitive. Like, your body is so self-aware. We just don't know that we are self-aware.
What you're talking about is called thinking off, like a think off. So there's a jerk off.
Okay. I did not know that.
And then there's a think off where you can just think and get yourself off. The next time we see each other, I will be thinking off.
Okay.
Because you know what? I think that there's, for me, another reason why this jewelry and our collaboration, I actually think that you're the perfect middle point for this, because as a sex educator, I don't exist in the sacred sex space. Mm-hmm. And I often don't really necessarily find a lot of joy in the practices surrounding mm-hmm. sacred sex. That could be because of my own religious positioning or me being skeptical or just very pragmatic and logical minded. But I've absolutely tried and dabbled. It's just never really connected for me. And I actually look at you as somebody who's like kind of perfectly positioned in the middle. And for me, that makes everything more accessible. Like, I actually want to try it because of you. I actually believe it. You're the first person who's told me that I've been like, I've seen people have energy orgasms. And I'm like, okay. You know, you can tell yourself anything and make it true. So I don't deny that. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't look like the orgasm that I'd be having. It looks like something completely separate. I know you're doing something. I just don't think it's the thing that I get to do at night. But you're the first person who said it that I'm like, oh, maybe I actually can, and maybe I'll revisit this.
Yeah. So just to get you started on your journey, all you do is you actually become more aware. I don't know if you realize this, but for most people, even that you probably talk to, most people don't even look at themselves down there.
Yeah.
There's this heavy lack of awareness of their sexual organs. I think just understand, like, actually feeling it. Because if you decide to feel that inside part, you can't feel it. You can literally feel it in your mind. And it's just about becoming aware of it. Like I said,
I can feel it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, you can feel
it feels
the...
It feels like this. Like the lotus.
Oh.
Like when I feel it, I can almost feel it drop.
Yeah. I mean, for me, just... It feels like, you know, I can feel like I can fill it up. Does that make sense?
Like a cup?
Like an actual, like if it had something inside it, I feel like you can actually create that feeling, the sensation of being filled up.
Mm. Like a balloon?
Yeah.
You know me. I need mosquito bite. I need these practical, concrete examples.
No, like if somebody would, like almost as though you're being penetrated or even whether you're being touched. Mm-hmm. You know, you can learn to, if you think of how many nerve endings we have in there, those nerve endings are alive. Mm-hmm. They've got sensation. Most of those nerve endings get ignored during regular sex because you're just going in and out, right? So, for instance, one of the most pleasurable sensations for me during penetration is when my husband comes, and you know how the penis sort of twitches? There's that twitch, and that kind of knocks against some of the nerve endings on the anterior, on the upper side of the vagina.
Mm-hmm.
I love that sensation. That to me is like, that's really exciting. So I think everybody says different.
Does it have to be like post-orgasm, or can it be a toy that does that, the knocking?
It can be anything.
Or is it just specific? Because that's also the mental picture of your partner being satisfied and satiated and then throbbing with pleasure. It could be the story.
It could be the story. It could be, but I mean, it's always wonderful to have a story, but no, it's actually the physical motion. It could be anything. Mm. Could be the finger, you know, like, again, for fingering, we in the Kama Sutra says that, like, that finger on its own is not a good idea because it doesn't give pleasure, it just agitates. So it says that you should have different combinations of fingers. So you could have this and this, and that then gives you that. If you do that, you're going in deeper because now you can't that is more difficult, right, to curve it. So you're actually going in deeper, touching a different point with that. If you're going in like this, you're touching a whole different set of points. There's one which says you go in and then you do this, so it creates the friction. So we have lots of different finger combinations that we're supposed to try. And I think, yeah, I mean, finger going like that at just the right point. Maybe it's just like his, how long he is, where it gets to and where it taps, that's just the right point for me.
Mm. Okay, Raul. okay. Yes. So you're married now. You're starting to, through your partner, get educated about your body, learning more. What were you doing, like, education-wise or career-wise at that point?
I was still working on stories, so I'm a storyteller.
Even in your early 20s?
Yeah, yeah. I was working on stories. So it was about learning how we position women in society if we, according to the stories that we tell. Came to live over here, started to work in as a tour guide around Europe. So I would take groups from the UK into Europe and then tell them stories around all of these places. And that continued for a while. And then the kids came along, and my mom had always been a working mom. So I decided that I would be a stay-at-home mom because...
Got to do the opposite.
Got to do the opposite, you know, and... Maybe life is much better for my children if I'm going to be at home all the time because mommy was always working. So I had my first two children. I had them on fertility drugs, could not get pregnant, had a long wait, had the two boys, and didn't work for a long time. And it was a terrible time because my brain needs things to go on. And I didn't know it was a terrible time for me. I didn't know I was depressed. I just didn't know what was going on with me. I just knew I wasn't happy. And I couldn't figure out why I wasn't happy. I have two beautiful children. I have a beautiful home. You know, I have everything that you would want to have. So what the hell was wrong with me? And then I have my third child, my daughter.
6 years later.
6 years after. And... literally, I think when I became pregnant with her, something unlocked. And I was like, I'm going straight back to work. And it was at this point also that I started to work on the stories around pleasure. Because I remember one night sitting up with her as breastfeeding. I remember thinking, you know, every story we tell is about your body being somebody else's property. You need someone else's permission to feel pleasure. You need someone else's permission to do this. It was always about needing permission, like you belonged to somebody else. And I thought, no, I don't want my daughter growing up in a world where she thinks that that's how life is. But where are those stories that we have shut down? And I decided to pursue them because a lot of people are like, well, what's the stories got to do with it? To me, these ancient stories are like role models. They give you permission. They kind of carve a path for you. They show you the way. They're very important for me. I am one of those people who needs to be able to follow somebody that's done something. So I know that this is what they did. And do I really want to do? You know what I mean? Like that whole idea of strength has to come from, because we are not told stories of a woman's strength aside from her silence and her sacrifice. And when we were talking earlier about the fact that this is a really feminine form of activism, where it just feels like you can channel your own energy. You don't have to take on somebody else's identity to be an activist. That's what I was really looking for. I don't want to be the silent, sacrificing person. I don't want to take up arms either. I want to be me. And so this is where I went looking. The first thing I did was to explore the Kama Sutra. Mm-hmm. Because like everybody else, I had no idea what the Kama Sutra was about. We were not taught the Kama Sutra and still aren't. And then gradually the stories from there, one after the other.
Keep going. Take me on this. I'm riveted.
So
Where are we at now? Were you at around age? We're in your 30s.
Late 30s by now. Mm-hmm. So I had Tharni when I was 37, I think. Yeah. So late 30s.
I had my second kid at 37.
Really?
That was my final kid. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you have time for another one?
No. I told you, you're crazy to me for three. Two and through.
I really wanted a daughter, and I think I got lucky.
You did, yes. Yeah.
I got lucky.
I love the two of you guys together. You know I'm obsessed. All right, so now you have three kids. You're in your late 30s. You are diving into the Kama Sutra. What happens next?
So two things happen. I continue doing the storytelling because this is just the research has started on the Kama Sutra. So I'm starting to work on it. I'm starting to try and understand it. Still working as a storyteller. And now I have, once again, the larger society around me that has banded together to bitch about me. Because now I am talking about the Kama Sutra. And how dare she?
Who?
Oh, people who are my friends. Mm. People that I, the social circle around me. And so suddenly now I am the slut, I am the horrible woman, I am the one who is having affairs left, right, and center. I mean, the amount of affairs I'm supposed to have had, I'm surprised I had time to eat a meal in between. Like, literally, everybody in the... If I've spoken to somebody, oh, well, she's sleeping with him. It was incessant, and it went on for a long time. And it kind of started to impact on my kids as well. So now we have people saying, and this is well into, it's not just for a couple of years. The more I grew, the work, the worse the bitching became. Because as you know, with most people, they will try and destroy you. There is a sort of crest. You get to that point where you reach a certain level of success, and then suddenly it all switches, but you have to get to that point because till then, this is like frogs in a pond. They will keep trying to pull you back down.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Destroy you before you get any further because how dare you be any better? And she and this other woman get together and they tell everybody that I am a prostitute. I'm a sex worker and that I get called out to the corporates whenever they need somebody. By now I am I'm 50. And I'm thinking the corporates are doing really badly. They need a 50-year-old call girl. But anyway, there was a recession. So yeah, maybe that maybe that's what it was. But anyway, I finally got to this point where I was like, no, I'm going to talk about this. I'm actually going to be vocal about this. And I don't know about you, but like, I kind of grew up with the sentence. So I won't mention names, but so-and-so, this guy was really horrible to me. And I was like, why are we protecting this person by saying I won't mention names? Yes, I know they're more powerful in society. Yes, I know people will probably still continue to be friends with them, but why are we still protecting them? This was the point of turn.
So was Seema Anand, as we know, born at that point? Because at that point...
A new Seema Anand was born.
A new one.
It's just, you know, because you add little bits to yourself, right? With each thing... For instance, I always say that when I started to work on the Kama Sutra, and I still remember, okay, I've been married, this year will be 40 years to my marriage. It's not been plain sailing. There have been ups, there have been downs. There have been very bad downs, there have been very good ups. But I found that the one thing that could always be used, whether by my partner, whether by somebody outside, the one thing that could always be used against you as a woman is your sexuality. I can be as good as I want. I can study, be super intelligent. I can work, be at the top of my game when it comes to work. I can be everything. But at this one area, because you've been brought up to believe that pleasure is a bad thing. Women are not supposed to feel pleasure. If you want pleasure, you are a bad person, you know. Having grown up with all of those things, or when you're not feeling good, when you're in a fight, no, I don't want to have sex with you, I don't feel like it, till things become okay. And then you're being told at that point, oh, well, I don't know why you don't want sex. You know, you're frigid. That whole sort of narrative comes around. And I can't totally blame Rahul because he also grew up with the exact same narrative.
Yeah.
You have to remember, he's 73. Indian man of that age, growing up in India, he's been taught exactly the same things that we have been taught. And so I still remember one morning waking up and suddenly feeling whole, because you're like, actually, no, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not frigid. I know I have the capacity to be as turned on as anybody. I have everything inside me that's working properly, and not wanting sex at this point because we've been in a fight, or not wanting to be with you because you have behaved in a certain way that's really put me off, or I'm feeling sad about something and disappointed, and that impacts how my arousal functions, is perfectly normal.
Isn't that so crazy, the dichotomy that you have to hold, where in your home you have to be hypersexual and sexually aware, available all the time, and in public you cannot be sexual at all?
Yeah.
And that is actually the expectation of both places. Like, they expect for you to be able to turn that switch off and on. And where does that leave you as a human?
You're not a
you're
human.
You're a robot.
Yeah, you're a robot. Yeah, you're a robot. I still remember. So, you know, your personality is a certain way. My personality is a certain way. I do have pleasure running through my veins. It's there. I move a certain way. I don't decide that that's how I'm moving. That's just how I'm made. I talk a certain way. I feel the excitement run through me a certain way. It's there. And I still remember this one friend. We were all much younger couples, and she was quite possessive about her husband. And I remember her saying to me, I don't really like you coming around for parties because you're a little too sexy. Even if you ask for water, you're very sexy with it. I was like, oh, I won't drink. I'm like, not even interested in your husband. Truly, I'm not. Honestly. You can be super sexy and super aware of your pleasure without needing to be with every man around you. It's not about them, it's about you.
And you can be super sexy and aware of your pleasure and not interested in having sex.
Absolutely. It is about you, it's about who you are, it's about how you feel. But this is the kind of narrative that needs to change. And that's where I, at some point, I think the day that I woke up thinking, I'm normal, I'm okay. And you wouldn't believe, I know it sounds really funny because it's just a couple of little words, but you wouldn't believe the weight that fell off my mind. Like, I just felt liberated. I felt human and real and so empowered that, no, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm okay. Yeah, it's a weird kind of point to have gotten to.
Is that making you emotional?
Well,
like a feeling of joy after that day.
And also just to know that for years, you know, this is how women were held back, by constantly making them believe that something was wrong with them. You cannot focus all your energy on being amazing if you're constantly worried about everything that's wrong with you. And we are brought up to believe that we're poised for failure. I mean, you look in the mirror, you are taught to look for the things that are wrong with you.
Yes.
Do you know what I do? So I am, as you can see, I'm overweight. I have put on a lot of weight during the writing of the book, particularly.
I'm not going to comment because that's a personal description that is connotative, not denotative.
There's no
definition that would define you as overweight, but if that's your personal definition, I'll let you continue.
Thank you. It's just that all those clothes, they don't fit, so you know that you've put on the weight, and it doesn't help the knees. My aging knees need a little less weight to carry on them. But I was just saying that I don't care that I am the weight that I am. I know that for health reasons I need to lose some of that weight, but I literally will stand in front of the mirror every single day with just my bra and panty on, and I look at myself, and I love what I see. Because I love my body the way it looks. I don't care how much weight there is on my tummy. You know, my waist curves in like this, and my hips curve outwards. And I look at that, and then I do this with my arms, and I get really excited. I love me. Sorry, it's just weird. It's just, I love me. I love me. Oh my God, I'm sorry for loving myself. No, but you know what I mean. And this is, you know, we talked earlier about the Kama jewelry. Honestly, so there's a chapter in the new book on trauma, on how to reconnect with your body and your desires after you've been through trauma, which was written primarily by Dr. Anvita Madan Behel, who's my in-house relational and psychosexual therapist. And we kind of went down this path of saying that before you allow anybody else to touch you, that you have to become familiar with your own touch again. And it's very, very gentle. It's very like, because your body is your worst enemy at this point. Your body is frightened of you touching it. And I just think the jewelry is such a great way in, where you have jewelry that has movement. You know, we've got this spine chain. And I always say having that hanging on your back, if you have just bare skin, and rubbing against that, it is, it's of course hugely sexy, as we know, if we're looking for pleasure. But also it's literally reintroducing you to touch, to being able to say, my body is not my enemy.
Mm-hmm. I know what a fierce activist you are in this area. I thank you for that work.
And you, thank you.
But
I think together we do this, right?
Yeah, but I love the way that you champion consent. I love the way that you champion the nuances around consent. It's one of my favorite parts of the work that you do. And on that note, because we could probably talk for hours, and we've probably been talking for about an hour and some change right now. Take me what happens next. You wake up one day and you say, I'm motherfucking fine. In both senses of the word. I am hot, I am fiery, I am sexy, and I am okay. I am not a project that needs to be worked on. I am not a broken piece of pottery that must be glued back together. I am not a piece of clay that must be molded in a different direction. I'm just me, and that's perfectly okay. Where do we go from there?
So, interestingly, I decide that I want to better myself. I want to upskill in everything. So I'm okay. I love myself. Yes, all of that. But how can I be more amazing for me? Because I've now discovered that this is all about me. This is, because the more I learn, the more I do, the more I understand, the more aware I become, the more fabulous I feel. So it's about getting to that point. And then as I study the Kama Sutra, it was when I actually got to this point about the jewelry. And then into this journey came you.
I think the first thing that you taught me about was Yoni Puja.
Oh, really?
Yeah, That's how I first found you.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think it was through storytelling. I think I watched your video like over and over again, but it was since that it was love at first sight.
Oh.
I really just adored you. And I don't even know how years later I found out that you were following me too. And as soon as I did, I was like, can I interview you? And then I guess the rest is history there. The last, I guess, line of questioning I have, I can't promise it's the last question, but the last line of questioning I have is, you're in your 60s now, you are in the prime of your career right now, you are incredibly sexy and sensual, just a cover girl recently, let's put some respect on it. What's your Shakti like these days? And where do you envision, you know, for you it's always been about having stories that guide you, because you want a path to follow. In this next part of your sensual, sexual life, what path are you following? What inspires you?
I think for everybody who knows me, at this point, I am not able to go and look for more stories. And that in ordinary language means that my Shakti is at an all-time low. Because what really gets me going is that whole research, looking for the new story, discovering something new. And I'm having to really push myself to do that. I've had a couple of health issues I've also had to travel a lot. As you know, since COVID finished, somehow the world went into overdrive. We're all in overdrive at the moment. And the running around has taken its toll. The constant travel, the flying everywhere. Just, it's taken its toll, not on, well, not so much on my body. That comes as a side effect to this. But on my mind, you know, I'm not used to waking up every morning and reading abuse about myself, reading death threats, reading threats. And no matter what you say, that, yeah, I know it's nothing, it does affect you. I had got to a point where I could not sleep at night because I was up all night thinking of responses to these people. You know, that was all that was going around in my head. And so at the start of this year, I actually stopped looking at comments. I stopped responding. Just stopped engaging because I needed to step back from the horror that was going on. And like I said, when your mind is in turmoil, you can't do anything. Like my mind is blocking me from exercising. My mind is blocking me from feeling happy. My mind is blocking me from reading a book. Like my happiest moments are me with a book. So Shakti is not great. Shakti is building up. I'm getting there. I have been doing some research on... So the Kama Sutra has something called the 64 skills. And most people think that that's 64 ways of having sex, which is not the case. These are skills that you were supposed to have because the idea was that what made you more attractive was having a really diverse personality. So if you could just talk about the one thing, after a little while, you become boring, no matter how amazing that one thing is. Somebody who could do more, somebody who was able to do more, you know, you just have this personality development. Those are the 64 skills of the Kama Sutra. And then you have another 64 skills of the Panchalika courtesans. And those aren't ever written about. The Panchalika courtesans were the most well-known courtesans of ancient India. And this is about the transition. How do you actually take the 64 skills of the Kama Sutra, which talk about all the amazing things you're supposed to, and convert that into what you do in bed? That's what I'm working on right now. Wish me daydreams.
I wish you daydreams. I wish your dream come trues. I just wish you love and pleasure and joy in all that you've brought to my life.
Thank you. And you, Sean. Look, I'm going to get all teary and then my makeup will run.
We don't want that.
No.
No, we don't. Let's move our hips. We're going to do a bicycle with our legs.
I love to know that stories make you orgasmic because they're so often that we're on like business calls. You know, we're talking about sales and numbers and tariffs and everything like that. And then you're like, but I just read this story. So what if we design this new jewelry piece? And we're like, Seema, we're trying to focus here. But I love to know. I love your stories. And I love hearing that they make you orgasmic because it is something that always lights you up and your mind is always going. And so if you're having a block right now, know that the people around you, me as one of them, and I'm sure Manasvi would say the same, we don't see that. We feel the flow and we benefit from the flow. And it feels like summer rain. Not this shit. Okay, so tell me a story.
Tell you a story. Oh. Kama, the god of love and desire, falls in love with this young...
Hello.
Hey.
So I need help mixing here.
We're at the end, babe. I'm getting told stories.
Oh.
Seema's telling me a story. Come.
Do you guys want to step outside for a second?
No, she's really back here for... She's actually really back here for the toy you gave her. Okay, finish up.
Yeah, so in this one, what I love is... So he is flirting with her. That's all that happens. And then the husband finds her. And she knows that she's listening to him flirting. And she knows that this is the wrong thing to be doing, but it's the first time anybody's ever spoken to her like this. And she's really enjoying it. She has a smile on her face and she's standing there with her head bowed. And the husband decides to curse her. But Kama doesn't run. He tries to stand up for her. And he says, no, it wasn't her fault. And he says, well, she listened. And he says, yes, but there's a way of atoning for every sin. It's not her fault. The husband is absolutely insistent. So she gets turned to stone, and she's known as the broken stone because she's standing like this. She's just getting told off and standing like this. But the story doesn't actually end there. So the story then says that, yes, she gets turned into stone and that's her, but...
So Kamadeva stands up for her.
Which is amazing, but he still the husband still turns her into stone. Mm-hmm. But at this point, instead of being ousted, she mingles with the earth. And this becomes a spot where people who have committed adultery can actually go to beg forgiveness. So she literally becomes the support system of other women who've been in her place. And I love this idea that she was made stone. She was chucked out of society by a man, but the earth, the other woman, takes her on, and the women and their energies get together and become that rock for the next woman who needs that.
Doesn't that sound like your story?
It's all our stories, right? It's us. And I love this story.
I also love hearing any stories about Kamadeva because, of course, we have his parrot.
Yes.
Proudly in the center of our choker. To close, tell us why we should proudly wear the parrot.
Well, the parrot, of course, is the banner for Kamadeva. It's for the god of love and desire. But also, the parrot is supposed to be in our mythology, this bird of steadfastness, you know, true love, etc. But I think that for some reason, it is also, you know, the goddess, when we have our 9-day celebration, the Navratri. And each day, the goddess is supposed to change a little bit. So this is a prayer to us. This is a celebration, a festival of the goddess. So on each day, the goddess changes. She becomes something else. And on the final day, she becomes what is known as the Shukasarika, which is she holds both parrots, the male and the female. So it's where you reach that higher level of consciousness, where you become beyond gender, beyond distinction. You become yourself completely.
It was right there.
It's right there.
For the world to see. We really did that.
Oh my goodness, that was a lot of talking.
It was. There's our hand-to-hand combat. On behalf of Seema and all of the other incredibly wise, incredibly hot women of this world who come to teach us in their older years that there is nothing more powerful than standing naked in the mirror and looking yourself in the eye and saying and believing there's nothing wrong with me. I would love to go through a 10-step class today for how to defeat shame, some evidence-based practices that you can utilize in your everyday life if shame ever creeps up. So the 8 ways in which we can combat shame that are, I will also put a descriptor in our class at the very end so that you have a list to all the research should you want to go and jump on and explore some more of these concepts. So that is through normalizing, through universality, cognitive reappraisal and attribution shift, which again goes to our CBT focused. 3 is body de-shaming responses, so somatic integration. 4 is gradual exposure to vulnerability. 5 is pleasure as counter conditioning. 6 is witnessing and co-regulation. 7 is reconnection to agency. And 8 is the integration of erotic intelligence. I'll also put an extra caveat. It's integration of historical and ancestral intelligence. And before we go into those points, I would just love to get a reflection point, maybe from 3 people or so here. What role does shame play in your life, if any?
This is so funny timing. I had a conversation earlier pertaining to shame. And what I realized about shame is that it is a limiting emotion always. It doesn't allow you to grow beyond. When somebody tries to teach or socialize you with shame, what ends up happening is it creates a barrier between you and exploration. I had a shameful relationship that was built for me surrounding sex. And as I got older, it created a barrier between me and exploring what felt good in my body.
Same here. I feel like shame currently in my life, or as I was growing up, gave me paralysis. I don't know if it's analysis paralysis, but in certain situations that I would find myself in, I didn't recognize how deeply rooted shame and guilt were in my life. So as I'm going through this unlearning process currently, I'm realizing like, you're not as far as you think you are. Like you can go further. And that is the thing that I'm recognizing, how deeply rooted from childhood and religious beliefs and all the other things that Shan listed that are still within me.
When I first got into sex ed work, the big thing that I felt, obviously for years, I felt shame for my sexual choices and for my desire to be a sexual individual. And then when I became a sex educator, there was an immense amount of shame for coming to that decision and for the impact that that had on my parents' lives or people's perception of me. And the way that I was able to get over the shame of talking about sex for a living, and trust me, there was plenty of it, was I started to look around at people and be like, okay, how did this person get here? They're here because two people f***ed. How did that person get here? Well, they're here because two people f***ed. And them. So this thing that everybody is making me feel so bad and alien and abnormal for talking about is actually the fundamental reason as to why they're even on this planet shaming me to begin with. So who really here has it twisted? Is it me or is it them?